I barked in his attraction.
I'm Jonathan Green. This is Lost and Found. This week, a walk through queer Melbourne. There's a new report, a history of LGBTIQ plus Victoria in 100 places and objects. Now, time prevented us from examining all 100, but with historian Graham Willett from the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives, we picked a select few. Graham Willett, hello.
Hello.
Here we are, the front steps of the State Library. We are unobserved at this point by Justice Barry to our front.
We are, but we're observed by many other people.
Why have you brought us here?
The State Library is a great place to start. We, at the Australian Queer Archives, have history walks, and they're scattered all over Melbourne, but the ones that are in the central districts, as the ones that are in the central business district, often start here because it lets us talk about the different ways in which we can access the queer past and some of the skills that we need and the resources that we need.
We are, of course, in front of the state's great repository. This is the archive of Victoria.
We are. I mean, the biggest collection of Australian queer history is the Australian Queer Archives. 550 shelf metres of everything you can think of. But the Public Record Office and the State Library have their own materials and collections, so that if you're doing anything about queer history, you're going to end up in one or more of those three places.
We're going to go for a walk. We're going to turn a queer eye to central Melbourne.
We are, and this is another reason why this is a good place. Of course, they have books and magazines, personal collections and so on in the State Library, and police records, medical institutions, collections in the Public Record Office. But here we can start by recognising those important contributions and resources. But we can also start here because we can think about this as a place that the queer eye will see differently to the way in which the City Fathers might have expected us to see it.
Do tell.
Funny you should ask. Over here we have the statue of St. George.
Yep.
Naked man, rearing horse, huge lance. I mean, you don't have to be Sigmund Freud to think about how this might appeal.
It is a very big lance, piercing the dragon.
He is. It just gets better and better. The more you look at it, the more you see. Not at all, I would think, what the City Fathers had in mind when they
erected it.
We don't. We bring our queer eye to it. We think, hello. I first brought my queer eye to it as a teenager. I didn't know what I was thinking, but in retrospect, it was very clear what I thought was going on.
It just rang a bell somewhere deep inside.
It did. On the other side, we have St. Joan of Arc. And if there were a patron saint of cross-dressing, it would obviously be her. So we give her that credit when we're standing here too.
I suspect too, a library, it's a place of meeting.
It is. It has always been a place of meeting. Less so now, because people meet online. But it has a long history of people meeting in the basement toilets, basically. I say people, men, actually.
I was thinking of the dome reading room, but
I don't know that was ever a cruising place, but you know, what do I know?
You mentioned, when we began talking about what was within these doors at the library, police records and so on, and in terms of the timing of this conversation and this year in Victoria is significant.
Yes, the 40th anniversary of the decriminalisation of homosexual acts between men, which originally passed by the Parliament in December 79, and then formally gazetted, signed by the Governor, in March of the next year. So we're up to 40 years now.
It's not such a long time.
It's not. When you consider the laws go back to Henry VIII, you know, that great defender of the nation's morals, so they arrive in Australia with the First Fleet, Victoria separates and just inherits its laws from New South Wales. They modify the laws over time, so till the 1860s it was an offence punishable by death. By the 1950s, it's sort of falling into disuse, except the police would periodically get themselves worked up about this problem and take steps to eradicate the homosexuals.
I'm sort of tipping my cap to Tasmanians, who, of course, their experience of that sort of legal environment is far more recent.
Yes, yeah, so it was 1997 when it was decriminalised there. So it starts in South Australia in 1972, where they made such a terrible hash of decriminalisation they had to do it all again in 1975. So they get to be both first and second states to decriminalise. Then the ACT, and then Victoria, and then eventually everybody else catches up.
And it's an important context because in the walk we're going to have today, the sort of Melbourne that we are revisiting is a flourishing queer scene that thrived in the face of that illegality.
Yes, and it thrived in the city for a very long time, although there's not much left in CBD now. It's moved, decamped, we might say, to the inner suburbs and then beyond. But certainly the point about the queer histories we discover is that people always manage to be and do queer things, even against the law.
Well, with the last lingering look towards St George, your saintliness, where are we off to?
We're off to Maya, the department.
Of course.
Of course.
My baby don't care for clothes. My baby just cares for me.
The next places we want to talk about today were places where camp people did, in fact, gather and enjoy themselves in different ways.
Places of safety, perhaps?
Safety and pleasure. It wasn't all about hiding. It was all about meeting other people, having a good time, letting your hair down, getting a job. These were things that people were able to do with a bit of care and a bit of discretion and a bit of luck. You could have a perfectly nice life. Nothing like the one that we take for granted. But they didn't know that this was possible. They don't think, oh dear, if only we could all be out, and, you know, marching in the streets and things. These were ideas that only emerged in the 70s, really.
It's a rapid transformation, a wonderful one, a rapid one.
I feel incredibly lucky to have lived through it, too. You know, I came out in 79. It was still against the law for men to have sex with each other, to proposition another man for sex, to hang around in a public place with the off chance you might find someone to proposition. And now we've moved all the way towards decriminalisation, but then a whole series of other rights and so on carried on in legislatures. But also just a different world. People are much more accepting, tolerant of the diversity that the city embodies.
Yes, and for a city, well, a city is all those things. A city is all its people. A city is all the things that happen within it. It has to acknowledge all those things to be whole.
One of the things we've recently done was a report for the Heritage Victoria, which is part of one of those big government agencies, looking at 100 places and objects, collections and precincts of significance to queer Victorians. And for us at the archives, it's always been about the collection and the history. Working out the difference between history and heritage was really important.
And places such as...
Yes. Yeah. And having to focus on the places and work out, well, why are they significant to us? And that was part of the joy of the project, really.
A little tune there for us. Soundtrack of our lives. Right, we're about to head into the Bourke Street Mall. Maya lies before us.
I know, and I mean, the mall, I remember life before there was a mall. I remember a life where, you know, Collins and Bourke stopped at Spencer Street. So the city's been physically transformed, but much more importantly, I think, it's been culturally and socially transformed too.
All right, well, I think we can... It's naughty, the lights are against us, but let's do it.
Right?
Come on.
What's life without danger, Fat?
What a beautiful morning for it.
Oh, it's always like this in Melbourne, always.
Why Maya and not David Jones?
Because we happen to have the stories about Maya, and because a particular person, Freddie Asmussen, who was a very well-known Melbourne personality at the time, and enters into queer history very quickly and into the remembrance of that queer history really beginning in the 80s and 90s.
Tell us a bit more about him.
So Freddie was the head of design at Meyer. And this was a time, people will know the Christmas windows. In those days, design was a year-round project. We're constantly renewing what was on show and how it was shown. It was an important part of the selling process, getting people in, not just for the products, but also for the experience. Freddie was, I guess we might say, openly flamboyant. He was very camp in that sort of theatrical sense. He's said to have wandered around the store waving a red rose. He was also willing, indeed keen, to employ young camp men to be his window dressers, to be his team. And in that period, this in the 50s, it wasn't common, it wasn't easy to get a job if you were camp. You would have to hide it from people. With Freddie, you didn't have to hide it. He was not interested in them sexually. His taste ran in completely the opposite direction in terms of men. But he believed, I would think, that camp men were naturally artistic, inclined to the design world and so on. So he would let people apply. He was a hard taskmaster. His talks of tantrums and screaming and stuff and tear it all down, do it all again, stay here till you get it right. But on the other hand, you know, he would give these people jobs and they were intensely loyal to him. They called themselves Freddie's Boys. And they were in a kind of constant competition with the boys, the window dressers from Buckley and Nunn over the road, from George's up the road. It was a kind of very refined kind of street gangs sitting in cafes and taunting each other.
Flinging rose petals at one another.
That sort of thing, yes.
And the names you mentioned there, George's, Buckley and Nunn's, Meyer, this is transporting us to a different era in retail.
Yes, not just that those places existed, in the way that they don't anymore, but retail was, and there's a little bit of it now, but nothing like it was then. It was a really extravagant kind of thing. You had to get people in. You had to entice them with the experience.
Well, and there's a really interesting crossover there. Waiting for you to go past number 96 tram. Interesting crossover there between that campness in that commercial setting and its role in enticing the sort of the suburban feminine to part with its money.
Yes. We do use camp in two senses. In the 1950s, beginning in at least the 40s into the 50s and the 60s, the most common word that homosexual people used for themselves was camp. Camp men, camp women, camps, often spelt with a K, K-A-M-P, where it is said to have stood for known as a male prostitute, although this is not true, but this idea developed in the 60s.
It's a handy acronym, I guess.
It's called a backronym. You start with a word and you work back to what it might mean. I've seen drag referred to as a backronym for dressed resembling a girl, also not true. And other four-letter words, you can do the same thing. People have done the same thing.
We'll perhaps stop with drag.
Yes. But the camp in that other sense, in that American sense, is kind of flamboyant and extravagant and theatrical. That exists, but it's not used in the same way in Australia. And I think that's one of the reasons Freddie gets away with it. He's just, people can explain it away to themselves as flamboyant if they want to.
It's the Liberace
effect. Yes, that's right. He also had the advantage, he was taken up by Dame Merlin Meyer, the wife of the chairman of the board, a society figure in her own right, very committed to philanthropy. She would organise huge extravagant events to raise money or to celebrate family events. And she would have Freddie present the events for her. You know, he would develop and set up these events. Drawing on what people refer to as the gold room, which was hidden somewhere in Meyer inside the building, where Freddie kept all his bits and pieces that he picked up over the years in his overseas travels that he might need for the displays. You know, so chandeliers, candelabra, there's said to have been an Egyptian sarcophagus in there somewhere, fabrics and wonderful, wonderful things that he would pull out for the displays, but would also pull out for Dame Merlin's events.
This is, of course, a mire of a different period. I'm thinking of, you know, the Mural Hall. I'm thinking of high teas at the top of George's. It was a very different shopping place.
Yes. I mean, the Mural Hall was used at least until a few years ago for major gay events, the Globe Awards for community activism and so on. But it's certainly a very different kind of place now.
Good on you, Freddie. Is he revered in there in any way? Does he have a plaque? Or?
No, it's very odd. I mean, the man deserves a biography. He's absolutely fascinating. But I don't know that Meyer... They commissioned a history of the organisation at one point, but it didn't do much with him.
And as we look now at the storefront, the window display ethos has gone down the toilet.
It really has. Just at the moment it says mega shoe sale and everything's blocked out. But like I say, with the Christmas windows, yes, you get a sense of what it was like all year round.
Yeah, that art of finessing a mannequin is a bit lost.
Yes. Like I say, it was hard work. You know, the boys did get shouted at because it had to be perfect. Perfect in every way.
All right, what's next on our tour?
Next is Val's Coffee Lounge.
Come on to my house, my house, come on. Come on to my house, my house. I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you everything.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, with a queer history, where that history has been in the shadows for so much of that time, to re-establish that, to give it back its place in the sunlight.
Yes, because, you know, people... It's a hidden history not just because it got forgotten or ignored or forbidden to be talked about, but people didn't keep letters and diaries and address books because the police were a constant threat, that they would be used against you. You have some lovely letters in the public record office, love letters, that were in fact seized by the police and used as evidence in a prosecution. And we know of other cases where letters and diaries, and I said address books, were seized and used. And so we have to recover the history from fragments, from bits and pieces here and there. And then, as I say, the oral histories that we've been collecting, which now go back to the 40s. Okay. This.
We're here.
Coffee shop. A particularly nondescript site, especially at this hour in the morning. It's now it's an Indian restaurant.
Three curries with unlimited roti and free chai.
It used to be a vegetarian restaurant run by the Hare Krishnas.
The Hare Krishnas were here, yeah.
Well, they've moved on. There's also been a transformation because Val's operated on the first floor and in the basement, and there's nowhere now to see how you might have got into the basement.
Can you describe that storefront as it was?
Yes. So it's a very narrow building. You can see it from across the road. It's a tall, skinny 1930s building.
Why don't we pop over there? Because we're just outside the town hall.
It might be visually interesting.
Yes. And it's an interesting trick, I think, in observing the city often, is to get some perspective, to look up above the awning.
Looking up is really important. Just above your head on the laneway that runs through the middle of it, there are all these mosaics of naked men. Well, nobody told me to look for these when I was a teenager. And you're just constantly discovering new things. It's really wonderful.
Graham is saddened by opportunity lost.
Yes. Well, you know, I've made up for lost time. So
all right,
tall,
we get a better view
white
now.
Building here, the very narrow one.
Yes.
Shoe handbag repair, keys engraving. You would go in at the ground floor. And initially, in 1951, Val took up the lease on the first floor. That's where the restaurant is now. And you could go up there and relax. It was very, very... It was so successful that she then took up the lease on the basement as well.
It would be lovely.
80 people seated at each of those
places.
It would
be a lovely spot there on the first floor. The window bows out there above the awning, and there's a London plane tree slap bang in the middle.
Much competition for the window seats, but really you were there to see other people. It wasn't a pickup joint, although there's a story about that. But it was a very nicely, stylishly done, well, style of the time. So, you know, the tables and chairs were painted mauve. The floor had a purple carpet running down the middle, and the rest were parquet flooring. And there was a piano. You could get food there, very simple food, you know, snacks, really. A piano, there was room for a three-piece band. On Sunday nights, they would have events where figures like Frank Thring would turn up and read a naughty poem or two.
Oh, I want to be there.
Yes. I know, you do find that sometimes. You think, well, you know, we live better lives, but the 50s wouldn't have been all bad. There were standard lamps with raffia shades and coloured globes. So, you know, very exotic, very kind of quirky. I think even then people would have thought it was quirky. The regular singer was a woman with such a deep voice that people thought she was a man. Who knows? Maybe she was.
These things happen.
And we were right opposite the police station, which isn't here now, at the town hall. Val always said she never had any trouble with the police, which may relate to brown paper bags full of cash, but she just point blank denied that she ever had trouble or had to pay bribes or anything.
How long was Val's up and going?
Well, she kept going for years, but she kept moving around. So this lasted a couple of years.
Right.
And that stuff about the police is important because in the 40s, down Swanson Street and where the old City Square was, now a building site for the new underground, there seemed to have been a whole bunch of cafes and restaurants that were, we would say, gay-friendly, where camp men and women would gather after work, you know, at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock closing, you had to go somewhere, and they would have a lovely time. You know, they were a bit raucous sometimes. But they all disappear. We know this from oral histories. But then they all sort of disappear in the late 40s, early 50s. And I think there was a police crackdown. And it's possible that although Val didn't open until 51, maybe that's what happened to her too. And she just moved on. She ended up in Hawthorne, I think, and various other places along the way. She was very entrepreneurial.
It's true, though, what you say. And now knowing that about that building and knowing that about this place, you... Well, I grieve for that splendidness.
Yes.
Up there. It's because that is lost.
And her splendidness too. I mean, obviously, dressing up in drag and flamboyance is still part of gay world. But she was, well, the word she used was outrageous. She says, "We were outrageous back then. We rebelled against the dreariness of Melbourne. I was a bit hard to miss. If I was out, I wore a Homburg hat and carried a silver-topped cane. An Italian woman tailor made me beautiful suits which were well cut, in very good taste, and extremely mannish. I got away with it because I wasn't intimidated. If I'd shown any sign of doubt, I would have copped it." So it's the way, isn't it, a bit like Freddie Asmussen, you know, being outrageous, being confident, daring people really to make a fuss. Bohemians don't like to make a fuss about things, and I think that was as much true then as now.
Well, it is funny how in that period of time, straight culture makes a place for that world.
Yes. You don't look at someone like Val or even Freddie necessarily and think, poofed or lesbian, that sort of thing. You just as likely look at them and think, well, that's odd, or eccentric, or outrageous, or what show-offs. There are any number of ways of explaining this behaviour that don't lead inevitably towards their sexuality.
And I'm thinking, too, of Val's up there in the 50s, and yes, that Melbourne of that time, that grey dour place where this was, life was just beginning, life was just bursting up through the permafrost in various places around town.
She still lived in the city. I mean, at some point people moved out of the city, I guess in the post-war period, but she lived above the Tivoli Theatre, and she would find people dropping in after work, you know, 6 o'clock closing, or after the theatre, whatever time theatre show's finished, you know, for a coffee or a drink and a chat and so on. And being of a kind of entrepreneurial mind, she thought, hello, there's a business opportunity here, which is how she came to rent these premises. And then word spread very rapidly. It was always crowded. I mean, it was open from 10 in the morning till 11:30. They had to close at 11:30 because everyone left to jump on the trams and trains to go home. But in the meantime, it was open to everybody, you know, theatricals, bohemians, students, politicos, and of course, camp people. She herself was a lesbian. It's the kind of thing people would have known by word of mouth or by her being fairly out amongst her friends. But it was open to everybody who didn't really conform to that sort of grey dreariness of Melbourne.
Val, we salute you in your absence.
Hello, Val. In fact, we had her memorial service. She died not all that long ago.
Okay.
Above the town hall portico, there's a terrace. There's a great, you can see it when you look up. Looking up, that's the secret. And some people organised that would be the place to have her memorial service. we could look over look over her cafe.
Graham, thank you so much for this stroll.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Lost and Found, a walk through queer Melbourne. Our guide, historian Graham Willett from the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. Producers are Mira Adler-Gillies and Lisa DeVisi. Technical production by Chrissy Miltiadu. I'm Jonathan Green.